Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Well Armed Radio. This is our first test broadcast, so certainly we're going to have some rough edges here to smooth out as we work through technical issues. Hopefully my studio is functioning properly. To start with, and while I'm here, actually there's the call-in number. For anybody that would like to call in, 646-716-8739. As I said, we're going to test out the studio tonight. We do have some guests. We'll have, in about 15 minutes, John Monroe, attorney for Wisconsin Carey, will be joining us. John's out of the Atlanta area. Does a lot of work for Wisconsin Carey, and we'll be talking about the Fourth Amendment, considerations of the Fourth Amendment, illegal searches and seizures based upon what happened out in Watertown, Massachusetts last week. Some disturbing things to see as you saw police going home, police and federal agents going home to home. Knowing that the police knew exactly what they're looking for in terms of a suspect, but yet lots of people, fathers with babies in their arms pulled out of their houses. So we're going to talk about that with John, what the legal implications are. With that said, I want to make sure that we've got everything working from a technical standpoint here. So if someone wants to call in, 646-716-8739, just let me know that if you can hear me okay, if volume's good, any lag or echo feedback, please let me know. And we'll go from there. I'm going to the official start for Well Armed Radio is going to take place, I think, 2 weeks from today. It's going to be my first. 2 weeks from today will be the official launch. But with the soft launch today, I'm going to go over some of this again, but I want to start with just giving some background on what Well Armed Radio is, why I'm doing this program, and what we hope to put together. To start with, tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Nick Clark. I'm a co-founder of Wisconsin Carey. Serve as the chairman president of that organization, which we founded back in 2010. Got involved in the right to carry movement back in 1998 when I graduated from college. Previous to that time, my grandfather was an NRA member, and I thought that was something that either people were, country club hunters, country club shooters, ski shooters were involved in, or based on some of the things that you saw as far as advertising from the NRA, thought that it was more fear tactics and things that wouldn't really happen. So 1998 is when I got more involved in the gun rights aspect of things, and I'll go into a little bit more detail about that in a moment. 98 was when I graduated from college, from University of Wisconsin Whitewater. Grew up here in Wisconsin. Been here most of my life. Lived for a short period of time in Illinois with my dad, but I don't think long enough to qualify as a FIB. So I think I'm still Wisconsin proud here, though I lived in Illinois for a short period of time. Graduated from Whitewater in 1998. My background, my degree is in sales, marketing, and graduated with honors in 98. Also, a lot of my studies involved economics, so that's something that I'm very interested in. So well-armed radio, my goal here with this program is to certainly have a program focused significantly on right-to-carry issues, but also get into some other areas that might involve different aspects of self-reliance. You know, there's so much about right-to-carry that's rooted in self-reliance. When we talk about right-to-carry, we talk about not waiting for the police to be there, knowing that the police won't be there. With right-to-carry, we recognize that the only person who's able to protect yourself is yourself. So with that said, there's some other aspects when you apply that concept and go outside of just right to carry. There's some other areas of certainly my life and everybody's life where if you took that attitude of self-reliance, being a master of your own destiny, there's topics that I hope and intend to get into on this program that deal with that. I don't like politics, and I certainly don't like party politics. Sometimes, and I'm a big listener for talk radio here around Milwaukee. I'm broadcasting today from New Berlin, but I'm a big believer in freedom and a government of the people. And I hate party politics. Sometimes I listen to talk show hosts here in Milwaukee, and they seem to really, certainly conservatives, and a lot of my principles would be conservative principles, though. Certainly the definition of conservative is different for everybody. I would consider myself a libertarian more so than a conservative, though technically, you know, conservative relates to a conservative interpretation of the Constitution, which I believe I have. A liberal would be someone who has a liberal interpretation of the Constitution, someone who believes that the Constitution doesn't mean what it says it means, whatever you can, but stretch it and change it to mean as time goes on. But certainly, so much of my belief system revolves around that. I can't stand the party politics when I hear, again, back to local Milwaukee talk radio. A lot of times they're talking about what's good for the party and that kind of stuff I find annoying. I'm interested in what's good for the country and what's good for people, and I think both of those things are one and the same. So that's the other areas that I want to get into with Well-Armed Radio as we get off of specifically sometimes the gun topic and get into issues that would involve being master of your own destiny, being self-reliant, ending dependence, embracing self-reliance, empowering ourselves. That's what I hope to share. I prefer to share and bring ideas to the table. I hope that the audience and people listening will bring ideas to the table as well. Back to the concept of self-reliance, and so much of right to carry is based in self-reliance. Now, we talk about basic rights. We talk about the right to life. Right to carry is rooted in the concept of self-reliance, right to life, right to defend your life. All those things are basic human concepts. We're talking about human rights here, not just civil rights or constitutional rights. We're talking about basic human rights. That's what the right to life is. When we talk about freedom, you know, the two aspects of freedom is certainly the opportunity and the ability. You have to have the opportunity for freedom, and that's what government exists to afford you. Government's instituted among men to protect your rights. But then you have to have the ability. We want to explore freedom. We want to embrace it, improve our lives, live freer, live better. That's all part of what I hope to be of topic here as Well-Armed Radio evolves. So learning together, making this a journey is something that's important to me. There's a couple different topics I have to go over today. I'm still at this point hoping that on the technical side, everything's working well. I don't see, we haven't had any callers so far. So hopefully we've got the connection working well here and I'm able to be heard. Again, if anyone would like to call in, the phone number to call in, 646-716-8379. Call in, just let me know if you can hear me. Again, let me know if we have any technical issues, make sure everything's working well. Moving on, talk a little bit about the topics that we're going to go through today. In a few moments here, we're going to have John Monroe, who is an attorney that works for Wisconsin Carry, does a lot of work on a number of cases that we've had. We're also going to talk to, later in the show, Nazir, who is a Wisconsin Carry member, who also was one of the first, the first notable instance. Certainly, we may not know of all instances involving right to carry here in Wisconsin after Act 35 passed, Wisconsin's concealed carry law, but Nazir was the first publicly reported situation where someone used their gun to defend themselves and others after the passage of Act 35. You know, statistically, it's true that 95% of, or upwards of, I think 90% of times when a gun is used in self-defense, a shot is not fired. So certainly, even before Nazir was in that North Side Aldi show, we may have had a instance where someone used their gun in self-defense. But Nazir was the first public case, so he'll be on the show later. We do have a caller now, so I'm gonna take this call, and hopefully we'll get the technical issues working well here and see how this is going.
Adam in Wautoma. You sound great. Nothing too major.
Thanks for calling in, Adam. You can hear me okay?
Yep.
Good. Well, I'm curious, what you packing tonight?
Right now I'm actually just at home. I carry a Beretta PX4 Storm with me when I go out.
How long have you been carrying for?
Ever since the Culver 5 incident down in Madison, which really got me interested in the movement for right to carry and making sure the police don't overreact or react to non-issues simply because they've got a gun and a badge of themselves, making sure our government doesn't overstep their bounds.
Well, that's interesting, and I have a few more questions for you there. And one thing, a comment that I'd make is, you know, when I took the role as chairman of Wisconsin Carry, I had, you know, different, and I think some of this is I'm exposed to a little bit too much. I might become a little jaded, but you know, I think there's so much in terms of law enforcement that really needs improvement in this country. And I know that there's great, you know, police officers out there, and law enforcement, you know, has a tough job to do, certainly, but I think us, you know, being chairman of Wisconsin Carry, you know, we talk about ratios, and it used to seem like people would say that, you know, 10% of the police make the 90% look bad. And again, I may be jaded because of my role here and what we've seen and gone through, but sometimes I wonder if the ratio is not reversed, that it's, you know, 90% of police make the other 10% look bad. But certainly the incident in Madison was an eye-opener for a lot of people. So did you own a gun before that and just not carry? What was your background with regard to carry?
No, prior to that, I did not own a gun simply because I grew up in a family. My parents didn't have guns. My mom really dislikes them. Even to this day, she doesn't quite like myself carrying or my father, who started picking it up since the concealed carry stuff went in. Both of them ended up going through a concealed carry course with Gander, and so my mom's become a little more comfortable with them being in the house. I don't live with them anymore, but my dad's now got a couple more guns, which he never used to have prior to the concealed carry movement in Wisconsin. And they're getting ready to move into a more rural area where defending themselves are going to be more on the forefront. Law enforcement's going to be 20 minutes away on a good night. I got into carrying just because I believe in being self-reliant, and having been part of the group now for about a year and a half or 2 years, seeing more and more how that's going to be more responsible. We need to be less concerned with how the government's going to help us out in times of need and focusing on how we can take care of ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, as people start to study that, you know, you realize beyond the obvious that certainly when, you know, cliche coming up here in a couple seconds, but when seconds count, police are minutes away, and that's certainly true. So there's a practical aspect to, you know, right to carry And then also the principled aspect of it. There's, you know, people will cite the Supreme Court decisions where they found that police have no duty to protect you. And I think that's a shock for a lot of people when they find that out. It was certainly a shock when I found it out. And then after you thought about it, you understand how, well, certainly I can see why in an age where there's no accountability from government, why would they want to hold the police accountable for your protection? I mean, there was that case in Madison not too long ago with, I think Brittany Zimmerman was her name, but, you know, she called police or called 911 and the police, 911, the phone was disconnected, but there were screams heard, but 911 didn't call her back, didn't send an officer. And obviously that woman was killed shortly thereafter that call, who we don't know how long, but her parents sued after that. And I think the basis for there was a minimal settlement reached, and I want to say it was like $1,000, and the police donated, or there was a donation by the Dane County or something to a charity. But I think certainly that duty to protect precedent probably came into play there when that family was unable to seek a larger settlement or larger outcome from that. So but specifically back to when you started your comment that the Madison Five, so that Madison Five incident, you know, you're from the Madison area. You heard about that first, you heard about it on the radio, or how'd you hear about it?
I heard about it through the nightly newscast. You know, five guys, and I hadn't really known the carry laws prior to that. You know, I just kind of assumed it was up to the cops to carry a gun, that as a citizen you could own one, but, you know, didn't think much of carrying it out and about. It wasn't until I actually heard the 911 caller and heard that call, and she said, you know, these guys aren't doing anything wrong, I just want to make sure it's legal. And I believe prior to that there had been an incident somewhere in the nation. I don't think it was necessarily a mass murder or mass shooting, but she said, you know, the caller stated to 911, I just want to make sure I don't leave and something goes down where these guys, yep. I didn't want to be responsible for that. And when 911 did say, yep, if they're holstered, they aren't bothering anyone, that it's legal. And then to find out five Madison officers come, detain them, and issue tickets simply for eating dinner at a Culver's, which was friendly to these guys carrying, that to me seems, you know, something was wrong there.
That's what motivated you to get into carry.
Yep, and learn more about it and make sure that our constitutional rights aren't kind of quietly being swept away or eroded by our politicians or our law enforcement community.
Well, that's great to hear, and I know on certainly behalf of the organization, it pleases me to hear that, because that's our goal, and certainly we didn't wish that event to happen. Despite the news media accusing us of staging that was, we knew nothing about it. I mean, four members that met at a previous event went up there to have dinner, and that's what happened. So I know with the outcome of that case, you know, certainly I know that the gentleman who they could be listening tonight, the Madison Five, they'd be happy to hear that for all they had to go through, certainly the fact that they brought more people into the carry movement is a fantastic thing. So, Adam, I'm going to take another call here, or place a call to our attorney, John Monroe. So thanks for calling in. Thanks for letting me know on the technical side how we're coming through. And certainly when I get done, again, I'm working through the studio for the first time with a live broadcast with multiple callers. So definitely call in later in the show if you can get through, and let me know if you can hear when I have the next guest on, John, you can hear him okay. And appreciate the call.
It's all great. Thanks, Nick.
We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Adam.
Have a good night.
John Monroe.
John, Nick Clark with Wisconsin Carry. How are you?
Hey, Nick.
Good, John. I'm working through my studio issues here for the first time. I think I just patched this call in very roughly to the studio line here for well-armed radio. But we've got you live on the air now through the internet, of course. And wanted to just take a few minutes and to start with, I just had a nice call with a gentleman who actually joined Wisconsin Carry, joined really the Carry movement just after the Madison 5 incident. Saw it on the news and wasn't involved in Carry before that and got involved. So obviously you were a great resource for us on so many cases and that one as well. So it's great to it was a great thing for me to hear, certainly, that that was a motivating event for him. All the efforts that the people put into place, and it's nice to see the people took the time to recognize what was going on. But tonight,
yeah, that's nice.
I wanted to have you on to talk about a couple of things, and I think after we discuss my first topic, I wanted to discuss was the Watertown, Massachusetts searches, house-to-house searches that occurred last week. Certainly, from an armed citizen standpoint, I remember in the morning. I think it was either Thursday morning or Friday morning. I think it was a Friday morning when that went down. And my first thought through my head, and I actually posted on the Wisconsin Carry Facebook page. You know, if you were living in Watertown, Massachusetts, right now, how many rounds would you like to have in the magazine of the gun you're keeping at home to defend yourself and your family? And then after the day wore on, and I saw what was happening out in Massachusetts, I started to wonder if exercising your right to self-defense, your Second Amendment rights there might have gotten you shot, seeing some of the things that happened. So I guess the first question that I had for you, John, was, you know, a lot of people, you know, are aware that we have Fourth Amendment privileges and the right to be insulated from illegal searches and warrantless searches and illegal seizures, but I think sometimes in an incident like that, people might wonder, is there exceptions to the rule that allow the police to do what they do? So if you could speak to that for a minute, just kind of in most situations, police have to have probable cause to enter a home. What's the situation in something like Massachusetts? Do you believe that, the Fourth Amendment still applies in that type of situation? What's your perspective there?
Certainly, it applies. The kinds of instances that would allow the police to enter your home would be, first of all, of course, if they have a warrant to do so for a search or an arrest, they can do that. If they're in hot pursuit of you or someone else that happens to go into your home, they can chase that person into your home, which, you know, under perhaps different facts that existed, in Watertown, that might have applied, but I don't think there were any instances where the police actually were chasing one of the suspects into a specific person's home, so it probably wouldn't have applied. Another one is what's called exigent circumstances, which is a little squishy, but the idea is if the police come, like, to knock on the door of a suspected or known drug dealer and they hear noises that sound like evidence being destroyed, or, you know, they have reason to believe evidence is being destroyed, then they can come in to prevent the destruction of evidence. Just generally going, you know, house to house, doing a search against the occupants of the owner's wishes, that certainly would be outside the bounds of the Fourth Amendment.
And I think that's one thing, obviously, that we can't know for certain is whether or not that these people gave permission for the police or the FBI agents or whoever's actually doing these searches to enter their house. I don't think we can know that. I did watch some clips on the news where there was some, you know, there was a gentleman who was holding his baby, and he said, you know, I think some of the people obviously recognized a level of discomfort from what had occurred, and some of them maybe more so than others. And then almost sad to see some of them seem to be, and perhaps it was, you know, just based upon the time frame and how soon it had been after this event had occurred, and they're standing there in the news, and they probably don't want to look like they're, that guy who's going to complain about the police behavior when all of this had just taken place. Certainly a very emotional time for the people there, but it seemed like based upon some of the, you know, one guy said he was holding his kids in his kid in his arm, and then the police come pointing to the door, pointing guns at him, and it really brought up some third world type things. I mean, this is the type of stuff we think we see over in, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq when they're doing raids, not the kind of thing we thought we'd see in the United States. So, again, we don't know if when they go to the door, they ask if they could come in. But my first thought was that, you know, here we're looking at, you know, they knew exactly what they had a suspect. They had a picture. They knew who they were looking for. And certainly if they came to the door of a home and the homeowner was there and said, you know, we're all good, it was kind of shocking to me that the police, you know, even in some cases they had, you know, I watched YouTube videos of guys being pulled out of their house and hands in the air, and then the guy steps out on their porch and puts his hands down, and the cops quickly grab his hands and put him back up. So it, again, we didn't hear what was going on, but it didn't appear to be, didn't appear that these things were taking place with permission. And again, we probably won't know. Maybe over time we'll hear some more. But I think the next question I had for you was on a more practical side. You know, I'm sitting here thinking to myself, if I'm in Watertown, Massachusetts, at that point, I'm going to be, I'm going to have my AR-15 strapped over my back and my Glock on my hip, and you know, the police come to the door, and that's a condition that I'm going to be standing in. I obviously might wonder how I'm going to be treated, but what's a citizen to do? I mean, my first thought might be, you know, you do whatever the guys with guns tell you to do, but you know, what's your advice there? I mean, certainly, you know, the time to argue about your rights being violated may or may not be when the police are at your door. Is that correct?
Well, you know, it's you certainly have to consider things on a, you know, case-by-case basis. So, you know, it's hard to give, you know, generic type advice. But, you know, if you answer the door and you're more or less surrounded by people pointing guns at you, it's probably not a great time to get into a debate or, you know, even a fight. You know, it won't end well. And I've had clients actually in that situation. I have a case right now of a fellow in Alabama who was woken out of bed early one morning with sheriff's deputies pounding on the door. He didn't know who they were. They didn't announce themselves, and they weren't in uniform. And he went to the door with a gun in his hand, and they dragged him out of the house at gunpoint, you know, and basically yelled at him for coming to the door with a gun in his hand. But yeah, I mean, if, you know, if that kind of thing happens, it's, you know, it's probably not wise to, you know, to try to get into much of a debate or certainly not a fight.
I think for me, answering the door at night with a gun in my hand is standard operating procedure.
Yeah, you'd kind of think it would be, yeah.
So, you know, obviously, some of the cases that you've handled for Wisconsin Carry, you know, recorded evidence and from voice recorders and those kinds of things were useful in terms of evidence, and certainly from Wisconsin Carry standpoint, from the PR value of them, a lot of those recorded, you know, people who recorded the interaction. Is that something that might be advisable for people if they're in a situation like that? Obviously, you have to do what the police tell you, but should you be, you know, if you happen to be diligent in having a recording device on you, is that the type of thing that would be useful later if you decided to pursue civil action?
Yeah, absolutely. I've had several cases where my client had made an audio or video recording or both, and those recordings contradicted what the authorities said and actually made the difference in probably in winning or losing the case. I've never known an instance where having a recording was harmful. So it, you know, it certainly can help, and it almost never would hurt. So it's a great idea to keep one handy and activated if you have any reason to believe you're going to have some kind of interaction that might not be completely consensual.
So a point being there, if you can, you know, it's important for people if they are going to document that they did not give permission for their house to be entered. That's without that evidence or without that recording, it's going to be their word against yours or some squishy gray area of what you did or didn't say or did you step out or did you, you know, what did you do? So, so certainly, you know, I've seen how valuable that's been, and so that would be advice to people is if you have recording, and certainly now with cell phones, pretty much everybody in their pocket has a recording device, but record the interaction, let the police or the agents that are at the door know that you don't consent to any searches, but that you're going to do what they tell you, basically.
Yeah, and your point about cell phones, if, you know, if you have a smartphone, there are several great digital recorder apps. that you can download either for free or there's some for, you know, for pay, but that make it very simple to use them, you know, that you can have them on your homepage and activate them, you know, without looking almost and very quickly. So it's definitely a good idea to have one and know how to use it so that, you know, when the time comes, you're not fumbling with it.
Yeah, definitely. You know, a couple of other questions that I had, and now getting past the Boston, Massachusetts scenario, and you've worked with Wisconsin Carry, and I know that certainly on behalf of all of our members and the organization itself, we're extremely grateful for all the work that you've done, and I'm confident that the billable hours you've put in are not adequately compensated to Wisconsin Carry to your value, but we certainly appreciate it, and I know I passed on our appreciation from myself, the board, and our members. So some of the other cases that that we have, I think the one right now that a lot of people have some interest in, and certainly with the case ongoing, you know, there's things that probably aren't germane to a radio program discussion, but we have the case here with Milwaukee, basically our Wisconsin Carry's issue, and I know there's a few other issues in these cases, but the issue that's that Wisconsin Carry is focused on is right now the procedure that Milwaukee police make you go through in order to get property returned to you. One of the things with this case that I thought was interesting was when, and kind of going back, and again, if this is something that isn't germane for the radio waves or the internet waves as it would be, you know, when we originally filed this case, there was a certain amount of time that Milwaukee had to respond, and they didn't. Can you talk about that for a second? What happened there, and what they were able to let have the judge let them do?
Well, yeah, that was a little odd. I actually used something that was, you know, it's intended to be kind of a money saving device, and also give the, you know, the defendant a little extra time to respond to a lawsuit, and that is when you file a lawsuit, instead of serving the defendant with a summons, you have an option of asking them to waive being served so that you don't have to send a sheriff to serve them, and the advantage you get is you don't have to pay the sheriff to serve the person, and the advantage the defendant gets is they save money. So that's you know, that's a valuable, you know, thing to both sides. And in this case, they didn't respond, and then so we had to have them served, and then they didn't respond in time to the summonses either. So you know, we had to file a motion for default judgments against them, and you know, that's just, you know, kind of time consuming, and you know, is a distraction from getting to the merits of the case. Ultimately, what we did was we took advantage of the situation to find out who some real defendants were that we, you know, wouldn't have otherwise very timely, and came to an agreement where we substituted some defendants for others and got the officers who really were involved, and it probably benefited both sides somewhat, but in the end, Milwaukee had to pay some money for, you know, for some time that we wasted on things we wouldn't have had to otherwise.
Yeah, excellent. All right, John. Well, I appreciate your time. I know it's getting a little bit later in the evening there on the East Coast where you are, but again, I certainly want to express appreciation from myself and the board of directors, and certainly on behalf of our members as well, for all the work that you've done in the past, and hopefully we'll get to work with you in the future.
Oh, thanks a lot. I certainly enjoy working with you.
All right, John. Have a good night.
All right, you too.
That was John Monroe, attorney out of Atlanta. We had another caller on the line who I was hoping to get over to, but he was on hold for quite a bit of time, so sorry I didn't get over to you quick enough there. If you'd like to call back, it looked like a 715 area code. It looks like that's probably Wausau area, north central part of the state, but certainly interested to hear if the on my end, it sounded like John was a little bit choppy, but interested to hear how that comes through through the internet to the people listening online. So kind of interesting that, you know, John's advice there, that when it comes to these warrantless searches, what appear to be warrantless searches, it's important, obviously, to express to the police or whoever's at your door that you don't consent. And in those situations, certainly advisable to have a recording device on that you can use to document that you indeed did not consent to these searches. You know, when I watch what happened in Watertown, Massachusetts, and knowing that the police had a description of their suspect, you know, to, for them to have to come to a door. And it just really seems insulting to the people of that town that knowing the police knew exactly who they were looking for, if they come to your door and you can't just say, yeah, we're good here, you know, that that's not good enough for the police, that they needed to come in and search your house for you. It's part of the sheep mentality, and there's so much of that out there, and I think it's a problem, and I think Watertown, Massachusetts really shined a light on that. I look at after, hopefully something good can come of that. After, it's unfortunate when we see these things happen. It's a little bit scary to see how quickly your constitutional rights go out the door. New Orleans, after Hurricane Katrina, when there was all the illegal confiscations, you know, law enforcement going from municipality to municipality to or neighborhood to neighborhood and taking guns from law-abiding citizens who might be defending their homes from looters and rioters. And then I know after that shook itself out, and it probably took months or years afterwards, I know there was lawsuits filed, and there was, I believe, judgments made against law enforcement, and there was you know, reparations that had to be made. I don't remember if they were monetary or otherwise, but there was some good that came out of that, some good that came out of what happened in Hurricane Katrina and the legal confiscations there. And perhaps that's something that can happen here in Watertown, Massachusetts, that when people see in living color on TV what happens when the police, you know, put a town on lockdown and start doing warrantless searches when there are no exigent circumstances. You know, as John mentioned, if someone comes running into your home and the police see them run in, that's a situation that can go after exigent circumstances. Warrantless search might be justified, but that was not the case in Watertown. We've got a caller back on the line here, so we'll switch over and find out who's on. Oh, welcome to Well-Armed Radio. Who's this?
Hello?
You're on Well-Armed Radio. Can you hear us?
Hello?
Sounds like there's a little bit of lag on your end. If you're listening through your computer, you'll want to turn the computer down and just listen through the phone. You should be able to hear.
Okay, 1 second. Hello, can you hear me now?
We can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling in.
Pardon me? Thank you. You're welcome. With regard to this Watertown thing, I don't know how they are in Massachusetts. Do they have the castle doctrine of sorts, and would you have to allow them to come into the house for a search then?
Well, the interesting thing about castle doctrine is, and I don't know if they have castle doctrine in Massachusetts. I'm not as up on Massachusetts law, but using Wisconsin as an example, because certainly if, you know, the people listening today, if this happened here, you know, we're in Wisconsin and our laws would be in effect. Castle doctrine has an exception in it, where if the people that are entering your house identify themselves as law enforcement, that's an exception that's made within castle doctrine, so that you do not have the protections of castle doctrine if the police or if whomever is entering your house is announces themselves to be law enforcement. I think the other exceptions with castle doctrine here in Wisconsin are if you're any illegal activity that's occurring in your house. So, for example, if your house is a drug house, you do not have the protections of castle doctrine. And then the other exceptions, I believe, are that you have to be in the home. And I want to say there's a fourth exception, too, that I don't have my notes in front of me. But yeah, that would be the case. And, you know, as far as castle doctrine goes, you know, if someone was in their home and the police did barge in, I didn't see any of that per se. The cases that I saw, the YouTube videos where I saw where people's homes are being entered, you know, they answered the door. And then again, you don't know what was said there. Did the police say, can we come in? Or did they just say, we're coming? You know, we don't know at this point. I think over the next, you know, weeks and months, hopefully that type of thing will, you know, some of the news media will be willing to touch that. But yeah, in the case of Wisconsin, if someone barges into your house, if they do announce themselves as law enforcement, the protections of castle doctrine don't apply.
Uh-huh. I see. One other little side note, if I may, though, is, I mean, I am all for the law enforcement also. Don't get me wrong. I just want everything to be as legal as can be, but I was quite concerned, and I did follow the whole bombing and all that stuff quite intently. And I was really concerned about the amount of firepower that was being used by law enforcement, and just was wondering where all these bullets had ended up.
Yeah, you know,
I mean, I didn't hear of anybody getting hurt, obviously, above and beyond that. I don't know how much of that was flash banging and so on and so forth. But as we're taught in our safety, you know, and making sure of knowing where all your bullets are going, make sure of the background, and I'm watching these videos and hearing gunshots, and I'm going, oh my goodness, where's all that going?
Yeah, I think that was something that, and I don't know if we still have a definitive answer or not, but that Friday night when, you know, news media was in the neighborhood when those, you know, what sounded like gunshots occurred, and like you said, I don't know if those are flashbang or not, I was surprised to hear later that the subject was, you know, the suspect was still alive in that boat with the number of what sounded like shots were fired. You would think that with the trained personnel that they had there, that if those were AR-15 or I'm sure the police had probably M4s, but if those were rounds being fired from the police that or law enforcement, that many rounds would have reached their target and probably been fatal. But I'm not sure if those were flashbang or not. So as we wrap up the call here, we're going to get Nazir here, the Aldi's armed citizen on. I got just a couple questions for you. What part of the state are you calling from?
I'm calling from Wisconsin. Right.
Excellent.
By Stevens Point.
Yeah. What are you packing tonight?
Pardon me?
I said, what are you packing tonight?
What am I packing tonight? If you're asking me, what do I carry? I carry a SIG 9, and then I also carry an M&P 40.
Excellent. How long have you been carrying for?
Probably about 2 years, but 2 years almost full time. My whole family was raised with guns and deer hunting, and even back in Wisconsin, and I can't remember the exact year when they made it legal to use the handguns for deer hunting, and it's been that same way every year, and so the whole family has been using handguns and long guns, and it's kind of like nothing new to us, so we don't really, you know, see it as an objectionable type thing, or somebody's got a weapon on them, you know, just everyday life.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you so much for calling in, and look forward to your listenership in the future, and carry on.
All right, thank you much. You too. Enjoyed it.
You have a good one. Yeah.
Bye.
So now we're going to get, and again, I'm working through my rookie maneuvers here as we're getting Nazir on the line here. It'll be just a second while I give him a call. Interesting juxtaposition there. Two different callers. One who is new to the carry movement sounded like another one who's been involved in the carry movement for some time. Obviously, Act 35 is relatively young, but sounds like he was raised with firearms. And we have Nazir on hold, so we're going to switch over to Nazir. And Nazir, are you with us?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Good. So first question is here is for me to you tonight is what you packing?
All right, since you are asking, of course, my baby has been released, my Steyr 9mm, excited about that, and XD45.
Excellent.
But,
well, thanks for
confidence.
Thanks for being on, Nazir. Last week you had posted the video, and if anybody's interested, the Wisconsin Carry Facebook group, the video has been posted there, the surveillance video from the Aldi's store shooting, where you acted as an armed citizen. I think the first public incident where an armed citizen with their concealed carry permit used their gun in self-defense. So thanks for coming on. I thought there was a lot of interesting things to learn, and especially with the visual, you know, as I said, that's been posted Wisconsin Carries Facebook group, so anybody who's listening and hasn't seen it could go to the Facebook group. I probably should have bumped it today if so someone could get a look at it. But I want to kind of run through that with you. Kind of set the scene for us. I forget what night of the week it was, but you know what night of the week was it? The time of day? You know, you were going to the grocery store. Kind of set the scene for us here.
Well, first of all, you know, I do appreciate you having me on and taking the opportunity. What you guys do at Wisconsin Carry, really empowering people with information and free classes. So, again, privileged to be a member and do appreciate that. Now, this evening, January 30th, 2012, I don't know what night. It may have been a Tuesday or a Thursday because I was picking up my daughter from a dance class at Madison High School. And long story short, we needed some items for breakfast the next morning. So we're going to go in there, grab some vegetables and some eggs and whatnot. But basically what occurred was we stopped and parked in the parking lot. My wife went in. I did not go in. I was on the telephone having a conversation. So as I'm on the phone having a conversation, my son starts crying. And he's in the car with his siblings. So what I did was just go in the store because it would be a little quieter. I could finish the conversation. So by the time I got into the store, she was walking toward the front to go to the checkout lane. And I'm still on the phone on my Bluetooth, you know, just continuing the conversation. And basically, I got to the line with her. There was a couple in front of me. There were two people in front of me, and there was someone actually getting checked out at the time. And you can see that on the video. So that prior to everything really happening or, you know, everything starting. I don't know if you want me to go further, but that's right where that's the scene, if you will.
So then, so you're in line. You're in the checkout line. And then, when the gentleman came, I say gentleman. I should use a different terminology. When this armed thug came through the door, you know, we can see on the video. He comes through the door, jumps over the railing. Was he yelling? Set the scene there. What was the first thing you saw? And you know, those first few seconds. Did it sound like just a normal commotion, or was it immediately? You know, did he say there's a holdup? What happened there?
No, what happened? Is first of all, I didn't see him come in the store, didn't see him jump over anything. What I saw in my peripheral vision is I'm looking toward the back of the store. My wife was talking to me, so she was facing me. She didn't see anything. I saw in my peripheral vision security guard walking, he had his hands up, and then I saw a guy behind him holding his arm out, and then I think he also had a bag. At least I can recall from my memory that I saw a bag. So I saw this gun up pointing at the security guard, and the security guard's walking away. At that point, I'm knowing, okay, this is an armed robbery. Something's about to go down right now. That's when I unholstered my weapon almost immediately. So that's when I first saw in my peripheral and started backing away right away. He did not, there was not any yelling at that time when I noticed him. As soon as he got to the cashier, that's when he, you know, told everybody, you know, said, you know, he started using expletives, if you will. So, you know, don't anybody effing move. You know, give me all the money. And, you know, then he switched from the security guard onto the cashier that was sitting down. After already pointing at, there was another cashier. She had just finished up her drawer. She was pregnant. So in the video, you can actually see she was about eight and a half months pregnant. So he pointed from the security guard to the pregnant cashier and then went to the cashier who was open.
And I, you know, I can see from the video, you know, you're backing away. And what's going through your head at that point? I mean, we often hear, you know, is it, you know, people, was it the, I can't believe this is happening. I mean, you had your concealed carry permit, I think, for 2 weeks. What was the first thought through your head? Was it, I can't believe this is happening, or you've got to be kidding me, or was it just surreal?
It was all of those things, actually, because I sat there like, okay, this, when I first saw him, my first instinct was like, this is not happening right now. This can't be happening. It was like, it was surreal. But obviously, it was happening, so my common sense kicked in, like, this non-robbery going down. Like, even though I have my concealed carry license for 2 weeks, I already applied for it over 2 months prior. It was mailed to me late, okay? But, so I'm sitting here like, okay, there's a non-robbery going on. My wife's right here in line. We need to back away, get away from this right away. He has his gun up. I let her know, like, you know, move. I don't recall exactly what I said. I think I said it's an armed robbery. She said she couldn't hear exactly what I said, but she saw the seriousness in my face. So I unholstered and I backed up, and she basically followed me to really get out of the way. And that was even before many other patrons had noticed anything, before
so
he started yelling and so on.
So did your wife, you know, was she aware you were carrying at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Did she, you know, did you get the, and I'm just, you know, there's no video, there's no audio with the video, so I'm wondering, you know, did you get the, Nazir, don't go over there, don't go over there, was it that, or did she, you know, how was her disposition?
No, she knew that I was serious, and she was just going to, she's following whatever I said, so she's getting out of the way.
Yeah, excellent.
You know, so she knew something's going on, and he's serious about it, he's unholstered his gun, I need to be getting out of the way. I don't know what's going on, but whatever it is serious.
So then, you know, I want to jump forward then. So the, you know, you engage the shooter, or engage the armed robber, and then as he, and feel free to, you know, share the details you wish with that. But I guess my next thought is, you know, take me through the few moments after you kind of made sure that he was all the way out of the building. Run through that part for me.
Well, before I even engaged him, he had the gun up to the cashier's head. He waved it around a few times. He's yelling, "Give me all the money! Don't nobody move! Don't nobody move!" I think he said something about "Don't touch your cell phones" or something. He was just rattling on a lot of families. You know, "Give me all the money!" He's yelling real, you know, obviously yelling real loud, trying to take control of the entire store. So, you know, I had my hands up, told people to put their hands up. I put my left arm up, but I kept my right arm down, and I was at the angle to him. So I was trying to position, make sure I positioned myself between any type of barrier. So if he did decide to shoot toward me or whatnot, that I'll be out of the way. So as this was going on, you know, it's a few seconds that it's going on, he's getting the money. Now, he already got the money, but he wanted more. So in watching the video, he told him to put it, I think, like the change or something he also wanted, as he had his gun right to the head of the cashier, who's screaming and crying. And, you know, she's kind of hysterical. People are nervous. And there was a customer behind him near the wall. So he would have been in the line of fire had I engaged at that time. However, I'm letting, you know, letting things play out. It's the robbery, it's an armed robbery. Okay, I'm unholstered, fine. But there's a guy in the way. I caught his eye. I kind of nudged him with my head, like, you know, move. He understood what that meant. He got out of the way. Yes, you see that in the video. He moved out of the way. At that time, I had a clear shot. Now, he had money in the bag at this time, you know, looking at the video, reminded me, because, of course, at the time, it was more tunnel vision than anything. But he had money in the bag. The thing that caused me to engage him at that time, because he had money in the bag, was he put the gun, he waved it, and he put the gun back on this other cashier, on the pregnant one. So I'm thinking he's getting more agitated, he's getting more loud, I want all the money and stuff like that. I don't know what he's going to do next, but he looked like he would likely shoot or something was going to happen next. And that's when I actually pointed, that's when I put my firearm up to engage him, and then I recognized some real bad decisions I made prior to that, you know, that night, thankfully, were not fatal to me.
So, and that would be carrying, I think you were carrying condition 3, is that correct?
Yeah, I had it on safety, and I did not have a round chamber. You know, both of these split-second decisions, I mean, it really cost me. You know, at the time, however, looking at the camera, and I remember the district attorney telling me, she said, you know, had you had one racked in and not had a safety on, that was center mass. He wouldn't be here right now talking with us.
Yeah.
No, so she...
And I heard a comment from someone, and maybe you've heard this too, but at the part of the video where you first raised the gun, and then obviously, did you pull? You didn't have one racked. Did you pull the trigger and it clicked, or did you realize, hey, I don't have one racked here?
I pulled the trigger, and my safety was on, so the trigger did not go all the way back.
Okay.
Okay, so I had to take the safety off, and with the stires right above the trigger, it's not hard to take off. Took it off, pulled the trigger, recognized, okay, I don't even have a bullet in there. So these were the longest seconds of my life.
Well, and
then I had to rack it. Whew.
And then the danger there is this guy now knows you have a gun, and I think, you know, and as I, you know, someone who watched the video, and I was a little, you know, interested, someone made this comment to me yesterday. They thought, well, when you engaged him, it was over. And I thought to myself, I don't watch that. I don't see that the same way. It looks to me like, you know, once you raise your gun, you're committing yourself. And at that point, I mean, none of us here are criminologists that study over and over every armed robbery. But I mean, how many times have you heard of an armed robbery where they got what they wanted, they got the money, and then they still shot the whoever on the way out. You know, they shot the cashier or whatever, even though they had the money. So, you know, I think that, and I, you know, the person who made this comment to me, and I hadn't had a chance to respond to him yet. It was over email, but that was my thought when I saw it. I thought, you know, just because the guy has the money and he's heading for the door doesn't mean everybody's safe yet. So,
and in this situation, when you look at it, because I have it from different angles, and of course had to edit stuff that wasn't necessary. But when you look at the video, you can notice that I engaged and committed at about like 0.1 minute and 22 seconds. And at that point, he still had a firearm up in the air pointed at another cashier. Now, the only reason he didn't get shot at that time while he was still pointing is because I didn't have anything ready to go. It was a safety net. I didn't have anything right. So he was engaged, and you don't pull out a weapon unless you're ready to use it. There's no, okay, well, you got it. I'm sorry. There's none of that going on. We're dealing with lethal weapons here. We're dealing with thugs. You're dealing with a criminal mind. You don't know what's going on. So after I did load, and he knows now that I'm pointing at him, he also pointed at me in the video. You can see that clearly. So you see him pointing at me as he begins to try to retreat. So, you know, and this is, again, this stuff is almost in slow motion in tunnel vision as it happens, because I didn't notice the barrier in the lane as I was trying to move forward. I hit the barrier, which, you know, it was just a crazy situation, but it was ridiculous. But, no, this is not something where you all of a sudden you put it up, then he sees you, you put it back down. No, that's how you get shot. That's how you get killed. No, that's not going to happen. That's ridiculous. And it was already bad enough. He was waving at me, threatening my life, threatening other people's lives, having his gun pointed at them. This was not a joke or a game. This is life or death. And you have to commit, because it's going to be you or them.
And I thought it was interesting, you know, you may have seen, there was a video, and I think it was from Ohio, and this is probably about a year ago, but it was just eerily similar circumstances. Well, maybe not eerie, because it's pretty typical, but there was a, I don't know if it was an internet cafe, but two guys came in to rob the cafe, and there was an armed citizen in there. And same thing. I mean, as soon as they saw an armed citizen, they turn around and hightailed it out of there, just literally tripping over themselves, hightailing it out of that place. I mean, you see a criminal turn just to a coward in a moment. And even in that situation, I mean, the citizen engaged them as they ran out. But, I mean, that's something that, you know, when you've got someone there with the gun, even though they're running out, doesn't mean that they're not going to, you know, over their shoulder, you know, still try to engage you as an armed citizen. So you really do have to protect yourself until you know that situation is over.
Right. You don't know if there are other people waiting outside to come in. You don't know if there are other people that may have come in the store to act as patrons. We don't know any of this stuff. We have to just stop the threat right in front of us. So what I did, though, which the DA, he mentioned about control, was after he fell, now I still had about four rounds left in my sidearm, but after he fell, after I knew I hit him, he fell, and the glass broke on the door, is when I, you know, raised up, because he also dropped the gun. I didn't notice him drop the gun at the time. All I know is that he fell into the door, he's on his way out, we're safe, I feel safe, I holstered my firearms, and I walked the door to make sure, you know, there was nobody else there and stuff like that. And that's when I saw he actually dropped the money, which I don't care. You know what I'm saying? It was more about people's lives. It wasn't about the money. I don't give a damn about that. I mean, all he had was so much as giving me a gift certificate. So, you know, they didn't let me even get the food I wanted to get that night. So it wasn't the money. But this man is, you know, coming in here terrorizing people. Literally, they're crying and screaming, and he's threatening to kill people. And it's ridiculous. So once I noticed him hit the ground, and that I knew he was hit, then there was no need to continue shooting.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So that's what I felt, and that should prove to be right.
I've got about 3.5 minutes left here, so, and I need about 2 minutes. I promised a couple people I was going to get a brief endorsement in for them. So take about 30 seconds and just kind of run us through, you know, the aftermath here. You know, first, you know, as the adrenaline, you know, the adrenaline dump after the body experiences an adrenaline rush and the tunnel vision, things that happen there, you know, I think what advice would you have? I mean, what happened after that? What advice would you have for people just to kind of make them aware of what the aftermath of a shooting, what happens at that point?
Well, the police, in this case, the investigative police that came to the scene were cooperative and very positive about the entire situation. I mean, the people called, we called and stuff like that. The main thing I would just stress is awareness of your surroundings. Awareness of your surroundings 100%. The second thing is obviously knowing whether or not to talk to the police at the time. So training I had at the time let me know kind of the pros and cons, if you will, and how to weigh it. And with such video evidence, I figured, you know, it would, you know, make sense. Talk to them, let them see what's going on. They viewed the video evidence. And then, of course, the fight came with them confiscating the firearm for over 14 months, which has been well-publicized, and WCI is helping with a lawsuit regarding that. But, again, the main thing is knowing your surroundings and where you are. I mean, today I had a situation where somebody was a young kid, teenager, is my daughter's riding her bike. You know, I'm Muslim, so you see the kufi on my head, my religious gear, my daughter's wear it, they're covered up. And you see, hell, terrorist, and then he pops a taser. You know, it's not a shooting taser, but he's threatening with a taser.
Nazir, I'm going to pause you for a second here, Nazir. I think my stream's going to run out. I've got about, I think, 30 seconds left. So I'm going to have to cut you off there because I don't want the call to just drop.
No problem.
Thanks
no problem.
Coming on. We'll probably do a follow-up. I think in 2 weeks I'm going to have my next show. So definitely let's get you on again and appreciate, obviously, working with you over the past couple of years or a couple, probably it feels like a couple of years. Glad that you have your gun back now and be well armed.
Thank you. And carry on.
Last thing I'm going to do here today, and I apologize, I was going to get a couple endorsements here for some products. So I'll do that on the next show for the two guys. Tactical T-shirts and 30 Below Leather out of Wisconsin Dells. We're going to run see if we can get this PSA in from Sheriff Clark here before the stream runs out, and be well armed.
I'm Sheriff David Clark, and I want to talk to you about something personal, your safety. It's no longer a spectator sport. I need you in the game. But are you ready? With officers laid off and furloughed, simply calling 911 and waiting is no longer your best option. You can beg for mercy from a violent criminal, hide under the bed, or you can fight back. But are you prepared? Consider taking a certified safety course in handling a firearm so you can defend yourself until we get there. You have a duty to protect yourself and your family. We're partners now. Can I count on you?
This safety message brought to you by the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office.